This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
On this episode of the Most Notorious podcast, one of the most heinous, racist acts of terror in American history, the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre.
And so this large mob of whites basically attacked Greenwood. They're met with fierce resistance at first from Obie Mann and the others, but they were just eventually overrun. And then what happened after that is this mob just went from house to house, business to business, burning, looting, and murdering most everyone who got in their way.
Hello all, this is Eric Rivenis with the Most Notorious podcast. What you're about to hear is an interview that I did over a month ago. I have been saving it for this week because June 1st signifies the 99th anniversary of these horrific events. And I wanted to honor it as near to the anniversary as I could. I have to admit, when I read this book, I was reduced to tears. This is about the full-scale decimation of a vibrant and peaceful African-American community in 1921, Tulsa, Oklahoma. This interview will give you an idea of the horror, but in order to understand the full narrative, you need to read about it, research it in more detail on your own. This is just a tiny portion of the overall story and a tragic and deadly lesson, if there ever was one, on the evils of racism. Let's begin. It is with great pleasure that I introduce my guest, Tim Madigan. He spent a 30-year career working at the Fort Worth Star-Telegram and has written for other prominent papers and magazines, including the Washington Post, Chicago Tribune, and Reader's Digest. He is here to speak about his critically acclaimed book, The Burning: Massacre, Destruction, and the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. Great to have you here. Thank you.
It's great to be with you, Eric. I noticed you're from Minnesota, and I'm a Minnesota boy myself. I was born and raised in a little town called Crookston, and a lot of my family still lives in the city, so I'm very familiar with your part of the world.
Oh, very cool. I think I read somewhere that you were a Gophers fan at some point.
I was when I was a kid, yeah. Yeah,
sure.
I remember the last time the Gophers won the Big Ten was 1968 or something like that. So anyway, yeah, my sports allegiances have kind of shifted to Texas now, but I did grow up with the Twins, Vikings, North Stars, Gophers. You know, so like I said, I'm well acquainted with that part of the world.
Well, I live in the past with this podcast. so far as I'm concerned, the Gophers football team are national champions. If we're talking 1934, right. 1935, right. Anyway. so this must have been a really intense topic to tackle. When did you first begin to research this? And when you did you find people were aware of this tragedy, or was it a relatively hidden history for Oklahoma?
Well, I, you know, to say that it was a relatively hidden history is probably the understatement of the last century. It started for me in, I think it was probably sometime in 1999. I was working at the Fort Worth paper, and my boss came by my desk and handed me a wire story from the Associated Press about something concerning something called the Tulsa Race Riot Commission. And it was a fairly short story, and I read it. But the last few paragraphs were said that in the early summer of 1921, a mob of 10,000 people basically destroyed one of the most prominent African-American communities in the country. And up to 300 people were killed, almost all of them black. And I looked at her and I thought, I said, what in the world? This can't be true. If something this terrible had happened, surely we would know about it. We would have known about it. And she said, I've had the same reaction. So she sent me to Tulsa. And at the time, a lot of the survivors were still alive. And I wrote a newspaper piece for my paper under the headline of Tulsa's Terrible Secret. I mean, this happened. It was probably the most horrible example of racial violence in our nation's history, and one of the worst examples of domestic terrorism. But no one knew about it. Even people who moved to Tulsa 10 years later would have never known about it. It's one of the greatest examples of willful cultural amnesia, I think, in our history. And so the newspaper piece led to a book opportunity where I got to explore this at book length. And not only that, what happened in Tulsa, but placing Tulsa in the context of what was going on in the nation more broadly at the time, the Jim Crow era. And what I learned was is that what happened then was perfectly consistent with that horrible era in our history.
Right, yeah. The book is intense because what happened was intense in the worst way possible. But before we get to this mass destruction of this part of Tulsa and all of the accompanying deaths, I would love it if you could set the scene for us. What life was like for the residents of the Greenwood District in 1921?
Well, by 1921, Tulsa was known across the country as it was called the Black Wall Street. It was known especially among African-American people across the country, as one of the most prosperous black communities in the nation at the time. And the way it got that way was, by and large, was that at some point after the turn of the century, they struck oil near Tulsa, and the sleepy little village became a, kind of a bustling oil capital almost overnight. And, you know, so people's skyscrapers were built, and White Tulsa, you know, was a very, very wealthy place. And around this time, enterprising black people, African Americans, realized that there was opportunities for them too. So basically what they did was, you know, they realized that White Tulsa needed chauffeurs and nannies and gardeners and people domestic. And so thousands of people would go across the tracks to work from the black community into the white community, and then they would come back across the tracks with sizable incomes. And this professional class sprang up in Tulsa to basically accommodate these people. There were doctors, there were lawyers, there were movie theaters, there were hotels, there were restaurants. You know, and it was really an amazing community. So that's what was going on. It certainly had its issues. And that's what was going on in Tulsa in 1921, was this thriving black community was happening there. And, you know, and I think that part of the problem is that whites at that time didn't take kindly to blacks who were prospering. I think that there's a lot of sense at the time that blacks should belong in their place. And so there was just, and not only in Tulsa, but across the United States, there was this kind of smoldering overt racism that was happening, that, and the, as I think I said, I wrote in the book that Tulsa, was an example of that and was kind of dry kindling, just waiting for a match.
In the years just following the First World War, there were a lot of horrific crimes committed against African Americans. I've done an episode on the Duluth lynchings.
Yes. Well, I mean, that whole period. And one of the things that I learned when I started working on the book and tried to place Tulsa in a broader context was that what happened in Tulsa was completely consistent with other things that were going on in our country at the time. And I found out about Duluth, and I found out about Chicago, and I found out about St. Louis. And so racial violence was just a fact of life in our country at the time, not to mention the more egregious aspects of Jim Crow, where black people couldn't drink in the same water fountain or eat in the same restaurants or ride in the same railway cars. And so that was it was an important thing for me to learn that, you know, the only thing that really set Tulsa apart was the scope of it. I don't think anything so terrible happened in any one place, but it was really consistent with the other things that were happening in our nation at the time, and which continued to happen and unfortunately still continue to happen in this country.
In 1920, 21, how predominant was the Ku Klux Klan in Tulsa?
Well, it was somewhat of a matter of speculation as to what the Klan's actual role was in Tulsa. But, you know, there's very, you know, strong circumstantial evidence that they played a big role. And just an example of, to give you a sense of the way it was at the time, that the first real blockbuster movie came out in 1917 or 1918. It was called Birth of a Nation. And it was basically a story about the modern Klan. And it evoked or invoked all the most vile racial stereotypes you can possibly imagine. It was just a horrible thing. It was done by this filmmaker called D.W. Griffith. And it was just a horrible thing, but it was endorsed by and supported by President Woodrow Wilson, the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, the most popular Halloween costume at the University of Chicago during this time with Klan robes. And so it was a horrible time. And so the Klan definitely had infiltrated Tulsa. To what degree they directly helped orchestrate or contributed to what happened in Tulsa is anybody's guess, but it stands to reason that given everything else that was going on in the country, that they were big players in what happened.
Yeah, there were some other violent events by vigilante groups in Tulsa in the years leading up to the massacre. One of those was against some IWW workers. In an event they called the Tulsa Tar Party.
Yeah. I was just, you know, just talking to the descendant of one of the Tulsa people, and he mentioned that too. That, you know, back in those days, you know, though the predominant, many more black people were lynched and suffered violence than anybody else. I mean, that was not restricted to just blacks. I mean, this was a white union guy who was strung up outside of Tulsa just a few weeks before this all happened, and. It just wasn't the early 1920s were not a pleasant time in our history, and that's something that I think that too few of us can appreciate because it's not something that's taught in our schools.
Right. So there are a lot of compelling figures who lived in the Greenwood community at the time. Were there any people that especially stuck out for you when you were writing this? People that you really wanted to get right?
Well, you know, it's been a while since I published the book. There's a couple of people. There's a physician by the name of A.C. Jackson, who is renowned across the nation. He's an African-American guy who lived in Greenwood and was familiar with the Mayo brothers and was reputed to be, you know, one of the finest physicians, black or white, in the country at the time. His father was a leading figure in Greenwood, and was very proud of the fact that his son had become a physician, and they believed that because you know, they were educated because they're making contributions to society, to both white and black people, that the racial violence that were that was befalling so many other black people at the time would spare them, that somehow or another the white racist would respect them, would spare them, had proved to be a pretty erroneous assumption. The other guy that most comes to mind is this guy by the name of O.B. Mann. And you mentioned World War One, and that really plays a big role in everything that happened, because O.B. Mann was this big strapping guy, and who went off, as so many African American young men did, to fight for the United States in World War One. And there was an assumption that if they went and they fought and they bled and they died for their country, that once they returned, that life was going to be different for them in the United States. But what they found was, when the war was over and they came back, that if anything, life for blacks had gotten worse. The bigotry and hatred and racism and violence, if anything, had gotten worse. And so, but now these guys were veterans. They had fought, they were trained in the army, and more of them were of the attitude that if the whites or white mobs had any thought of inflicting kind of racial violence on them, that they weren't going to go quietly, that they would put up a fight. And that is led by O.B. Mann and others like him, other veterans like him. That is what happened in Tulsa, really, is that Tulsa, black Tulsa would not put up with what was about to happen to a young man who was about to be lynched by a white mob.
Right, yeah. So as you mentioned, there was a lot of simmering under the surface hatred, racism already. But the catalyst in all of this centered around a young man named Dick Rowland and his relationship with a young woman named Sarah Page. Can you talk about him and how he found himself in the predicament that would serve as a spark for the later massacre?
Well, sure. And one of the things I think is important to remember, not only about Dick Rowland's story, but, you know, as is the case with so many things about Tulsa, what happened there was typical of what was happening in other places. And one is that it was very dangerous for a black man to have any kind of a relationship with a white woman at the time. And so much as, you know, greeting a white woman on the street, or, I mean, it could have been anything. It just was, you know, the reasons for this go pretty deep, and we don't have time to talk about them now. But Dick Rowland was a shoeshine boy, making a lot of money, working outside a hotel or a businesses in downtown, white Tulsa downtown. It was typical of, you know, the people who profited from white Tulsa, and then he would go back across the tracks and spend his money in Greenwood. It seems that he had a relationship of some sort with this young girl named Sarah Page, and who was an elevator operator. And then one day on the elevator, something happened. Maybe the elevator jerked, or, you know, it was. Everyone seemed to eventually conclude that whatever happened was somewhat innocuous, that there wasn't any real assault that took place. But anyway, Sarah Page starts screaming assault, starts screaming rape. And Dick Rowland disappears back into Tulsa, which is a very kind of dangerous situation to be in, you know, when a white young white girl is making that kind of an accusation. But anyway, Rowland is arrested, and the police investigate the case, and they had come to believe that there was really no merit to what this girl was alleging. But Rowland was being held in the jail at the top of the run by the sheriff and the county courthouse. Before this thing can finally get sorted out, there was a newspaper war going on between two papers in Tulsa. And one of the surest ways to get people stirred up and to sell papers was to try to incite racial animosities. And so the editor of one of the Tulsa papers seized upon this story and sensationalized it, and ran a front page editorial in the last few days of May 1921 that ran under the headline of "To Lynch Negro Tonight." Next thing you know, there are hundreds of people surrounding the courthouse, if not to participate in the lynch mob, at least to observe it. Word got back, in the meantime, copies of the paper got back to Greenwood, and O.B. Mann read it, and a lot of the other leaders in Greenwood read it. And next thing you know, their attitude was, it ain't happening here. So they they armed themselves, established a convoy to basically confront this mob. And the white sheriff said, boys, I've got this under control. Nothing's going to happen to Dick Rowland. He's going to be protected. Just go back to Greenwood. I think this happened a couple of times until at one point, there was an altercation between a white person near the courthouse and one of the blacks who had come to the courthouse. A gun was fired. Next thing you know, all hell broke loose. There was shooting from both sides, and that was the beginning of it. The blacks eventually fell back across the tracks, and then overnight, this mob of up to estimated at 10,000 people was organized and dispersed to various places around Greenwood. And then early in the morning, around 5 o'clock in the morning, there was a whistle, and then the attack began. And so this large mob of whites basically attacked Greenwood. They met with fierce resistance at first from O.B. Mann and the others, but they were just eventually overrun. And then what happened after that is this mob just went from house to house, business to business, burning, looting, and murdering most everyone who got in their way. And by the end of it, I say that Greenwood, the photographs of Greenwood resemble Hiroshima and Nagasaki after the atom bomb. The only buildings that were really left standing were the outhouses, because the mob didn't want to waste their kerosene on outhouses. But everything else was pretty much gone. And there are so many stories of just the most horrifying, cold-blooded murder of men, women, and children that took place over this time. So it really was a pretty amazing thing.
Yeah, there are a lot of moving emotional stories, as you've said. Can you tell an account or two that are especially powerful for you?
Well, I mean, there was. One of the stories I remember is there being an old couple who were an old black couple who were praying when the mob came in, and they would just be shot down in cold blood, and then their homes looted and their place burned. A.C. Jackson, the physician that I mentioned earlier, was shot down in cold blood, And the other thing about it is there's a system to it where and also airplanes were used. I mean, incendiaries were being dropped on these fleeing black people from the air. There was a system to it where the mob would go in, often kill whoever would remain inside, often again with men, women, and children. And then after that, then the women, the white women, would come behind them with pillowcases and loot, take the dresses, take the silver, take the, loot, everything that they could get their hands on before the place was set to flame. And the story goes that a lot of Tulsa residents years later would see a white woman wearing their dress, or see a white woman in Tulsa wearing the suit that they're going to wear to the prom, the Greenwood prom, and so the humiliation and the criminality of this is really pretty breathtaking. When I first went to Tulsa I don't think that there are any survivors still alive, but there were several when I first went to Tulsa around the year 2000. And, you know, and I remember talking to some of these people who lived through this, and one of them was a guy by the name of George Monroe, who was like a boy of 7 or 8. When the mob came in, his father wasn't at home at the time, but his sister grabbed him and pulled him under a bed. And one of the mobsters stepped on George's hand, and the sister threw his mouth over George's, or threw her hand over George's mouth to keep him from screaming, because if they would have been found, and God only knows what would happen. But he told me that story, you know, 20 years ago, you know, as if it were yesterday. And you multiply that story times thousands and thousands and thousands. Another older person told me that, you know, one morning as her mother wakes her up and gets her out of bed and said, "We need to go because the white folks are killing the black people." So the next thing you know, she's part of this refugee line of refugees fleeing away from the white mob. And as they're doing it, these airplanes are circling overhead and bullets are landing around them. So it's just story after story after story that stayed in the hearts and minds and souls of these people all these years. And for many of the years, until in the last couple of decades, you know, they carried these stories around them basically in secret because no one was talking about it. And so fortunately before, you know, some of these people passed on, at least the world through my book and some others, the world became aware of what had happened there.
While reading how this whole terrible thing unfolded, much of it reminded me of a battle from World War I. Machine guns set up on hills, firing down into greenwood, mm-hmm. biplanes strafing the street with bullets, snipers set up in church bell towers.
Right.
It's just insane when you read it.
It really is. It's hard to believe, really. It's hard to believe that anything so horrible can happen, and it's probably harder to believe that this atrocity would have happened, and then have been kept secret for generations and generations and generations.
One account that was particularly moving to me, among many, came from a boy who was white and lived on the very edge of Greenwood.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes. Right.
His side of the street was white, and the side of the street directly across from his was black, and he played with three black friends every day after school, three little boys, and he remembered with utter horror what happened to them that night. He watched from across the street as men entered their home. He heard the shots, and then they set the house on fire.
I remember that story, that this young white boy kept waiting for his friends, his black friends, to come out of this house, and they never did. That's another, you know, another example that I've thought of in a while. But I mean, that's just kind of the way it was, over and over and over again.
Another account that really horrified me had to do with a well-known beggar in downtown Tulsa. He was African American. He was blind. He had no legs.
Right.
And likely he hadn't even heard the news about what was happening. He was in a different part of town. And a few of these roaming vigilantes grabbed him in the chaos, tied him to the back of their car, and just began driving around town, dragging him from behind, right? Until he died.
That's what it was like. And the other thing about it, too, is though some of this is conjecture, the evidence, circumstantial evidence at least, seems pretty strong that the white Tulsa Police Department, the Tulsa City Council, the powers that be in Tulsa were very much involved in this. And this was endorsed and perhaps even organized by law enforcement. And, you know, one of the things that happened was, is as soon as this began, the whites basically started arming themselves and going to the hardware store and getting every gun they can get their hands on. And I think a lot of this, you know, again, at the under the auspices of the police department and official Tulsa.
Yeah, that reminds me of something I wanted to ask you. You debate in the book whether this was simply a blind mob or something more of an organized attack.
Right.
But the whistle that goes off at 5:04 a.m. that signals a charge into the neighborhood really does suggest that someone was giving orders.
Well, I think that, you know, again, in the days, weeks, and months and years afterwards, White Tulsa clamped down on this pretty tightly. But just look, you know, it just was too systematic. You mentioned the machine guns on the hill and the use of the planes and mobs being assembled at strategic places and the boundary. You know, that is just, it wasn't just a spontaneous mob. These people were being led by, you know, it reached into the very highest levels of Tulsa at the time. There's really no doubt about that, I don't think, in anybody's minds.
Right. It's just so interesting. There were men on both sides that had fought just a couple of years earlier together against the Germans in the war.
Right. Yeah. It's again, the horror of it is really kind of hard to believe. The fact that you could have moved to Tulsa 5 years later and never known this had happened. And I've heard once the book was published, and when I'd go on the radio or whatnot, I'd be hearing from people who said, I lived in Tulsa all my life, and until I read your book, I'd never known this had happened. I think the larger issue, however, is that, you know, they said I grew up in Minnesota, and I grew up in a little town and a farming community in the northwest part of the state. And obviously there weren't a lot of black people in the place where I grew up. So then, you know, after one thing led to another, and I ended up down in Texas, and I started living and working around people of different races. But I still was completely kind of oblivious to the history of things like Tulsa. And when I had an opportunity to, you know, because kind of by chance, because my editor handed me this story, to educate myself, my life really changed. And one of my favorite stories from this time was my first trip to Tulsa, my first reporting trip to Tulsa. At the end of the day, I thought my job was done, and I was out to dinner with a guy by the name of Don Ross, who's a state representative representing Greenwood, who was more responsible than anyone for organizing the Tulsa Race Riot Commission and the Oklahoma legislature. Anyway, he and I were out to dinner, and I was just trying to make conversation in this quiet Chinese restaurant in Tulsa. And I asked him a question like, you know, Don, tell me, what was it like for black people after the Civil War? And he raised his fist up and slammed his table. It's loud enough so most of the other people in the restaurant looked at us. And he said, and you're one of the educated whites. He said, if we can't count on you to know our story, who can we count on? And from that time on, and for a long time afterwards, his name for me was Ignorant White Boy. But he had a point. And so especially after I went to work researching the book, and I started to learn about Duluth, and I started to learn about Chicago and St. Louis and everything that was in the lynchings and everything that was going on in the country, and realizing that Tulsa was completely consistent with that time, it really changed the way I looked at the world. And it changed the way I looked at other people. And my theory is that once and if we can all really take a hard look at the history, it will change the way we view other people. And that has certainly been the case in my life. And you know, this, and I think that it's particularly important to remember that this continues to be relevant today. You know, we look at what's happening with the pandemic, and we look at the people who are being most severely affected by it. African Americans and minorities are the ones who are being hit by this much, much harder than in any other community because they're underserved. And the reason they're underserved is due largely to the same kind of dynamics that, you know, that had their origins in what happened in Tulsa. And so I just think that it's so important for us to learn this story, not just as a matter of history, but as a matter of understanding where we are now as a people today and how these issues continue to kind of torment us. And it's a hard thing to do. I mean, I applaud you for taking on this topic because it's not pretty to look at. And as you've said, the book is very intense. But I think that coming to terms with this part of our history is essential for us to kind of move forward in a healing and more unified way in the future.
Yes, for sure. So I wanted to ask you about the aftermath of all of this. Many were killed, some were captured, but a lot of people just fled as well through farm fields, etc. Can you talk about where they went and whether any came back?
Well, it is hard to know exactly. I think that thousands of people left Greenwood never to return, and Dick Rowland being one of them. The irony is that he ended up surviving, and I think he moved to Kansas City. In the days after this happened, the New York Times and all the major white papers from across the country came in and wrote about it in a pretty straightforward fashion. And at the time, the powers that be in Tulsa, the Republic stance was pretty contrite. But the minute that the national press left, then things changed quickly. And in fact, there was a move from, you know, among Tulsans to try to confiscate the property where Greenwood had existed and appropriate that for white Tulsa. Black lawyers went to court and kept that from happening. And so a lot of what had existed in Greenwood Avenue prior to it, it was rebuilt in fairly short order, but there was really no, obviously it was never the same, and I think that one of the reasons why the secret was so efficiently kept was that white Tulsa was afraid of the statute of limitations for murder, and black Tulsa was ashamed and worried that it was going to happen again. And so there were whispers of it, but obviously the nature of Greenwood prior to this was never to be seen again.
So Greenwood today, was it total destruction? Did any buildings survive? What does it look like now?
Well, if you took you would see it largely as it might have looked around that time. However, the buildings that exist there now are basically replicas of those that were destroyed. So what's really kind of interesting, there was the official death count was much lower than the reality. I think everybody agrees about that. But, you know, one of the things that were kind of seared into the memory of people who experienced this was seeing truck after truck loaded with African-American bodies stacked like cordwood on the back of these trucks, driven to parts unknown, and that there was an assumption that in and around Tulsa there were one or more mass graves. And one of the most recent developments is the mayor of Tulsa, a Republican guy, basically has initiated an effort to do scientific inquiries to try to locate these mass graves. And just before the pandemic hit, there was news out of Tulsa that the scientists seem to have identified areas that seem consistent with mass graves. And so at some point, they're going to start excavating. And again, it's the search for the truth. I really applaud the Tulsa mayor for doing this. And And you know, and next year is the 100th anniversary of all this, and so I think it's going to be in the news in the news even more, and I think that's a good thing.
I would imagine there are plaques, a memorial.
There's something called the Greenwood Cultural Center. There are memorials. The state after the Tulsa Race Riot Commission finished its business, there was some scholarships established, and so I mean the presence. If you go to Tulsa today, it's been a few years since I've been there, but if you go to Tulsa today, obviously it's prominently commemorated in Greenwood as to what happened in 1921.
For those listeners who don't know, HBO had a recent series called The Watchmen. It's kind of a superhero, anti-hero show, but it relied heavily on that history for its story arc for the season.
Right, yeah.
Did you watch it? And if so, what did you think about it?
Well, you know, frankly, I did not watch it. I don't get HBO, as they say. But I immediately started hearing about it. Because the opening sequence of the series was the massacre, the Tulsa Race Massacre, and people assumed that, given the horrible nature of what they were seeing, that it was fiction, and the director and producers of the film were, you know, in interviews during the launch of this HBO series, were saying, no, it's not fiction. This really happened, and in fact, there's the source material. The source material that they used for writing these sequences was my book, and they were kind enough to mention that in a lot of these interviews. And so that has rekindled a lot of interest in the book, and we've done a second printing of it, and I do think that. Hopefully, in the next year, as we go through the anniversary, that I'll be doing a lot more of this and a lot talking about what happened in Tulsa a lot more in the next period of time to come.
Forgive me if you answered this already. I think you might have. But what was the official death toll, and do you believe the numbers?
I think that the official toll is, the specific numbers escape me, but I think the official toll was maybe 60, 50, 60, 70, and I think that most historians and most people who know about this put the death toll at least 300, maybe more.
Goodness. Well, I really appreciate your time today. You have a website. Can you tell my listeners about it? Best place to get your books.
Yeah, I mean, the website is timmadigan.net, and the best place to find The Burning is on Amazon. There's a second edition that's recently been published, and that's the best place to find it. And, you know, and like I said, I think the world will be hearing once we overcome our current challenges next year. I think that the world will be hearing a lot more about what happened in Tulsa, and I think that's a good thing. And I very much appreciate your interest in it too, Eric.
Absolutely. I just wanted to ask you one more question,
sure.
A bit off topic. You wrote a book about your friendship with Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. Would you summarize that?
Well, no, sure. I mean, I met him. The book is called I'm Proud of You, My Friendship with Fred Rogers. And I met him in 1995 through another newspaper story. And one thing led to another. I went to Pittsburgh to profile him in the fall of 1995, and he and I became good friends. I came to appreciate that he was one of our civilization's greatest human beings. And I was fortunate enough that he had mentored me through some very difficult times in my life, and so that book is the story of our friendship, and basically it shines a light on his human greatness and a lot of the lessons that can be derived from that. It's much different than the Tulsa book, I have to say.
I can only imagine. Well, thank you. This has been great.
Well, thank you, Eric. And, again, thank you for your interest. I hope to talk to you again sometime.
Yes, me too. Again, I have been speaking to Tim Madigan. He is the author of The Burning, Massacre, Destruction, and the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. This has been another episode of the Most Notorious Podcast, broadcasting to every dark and cobwebbed corner of the world. I'm Eric Rivenis, and have a safe tomorrow.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello. My name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.